Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
The 2020s are lost. So it takes so long, even if everyone makes the right decision now, it takes a while to get everything going. So U.S. companies, including Tesla, will be reliant on the Chinese supply chain for the whole 2020s. And you're looking at the chip, what's happening with chips, that's batteries for the 2020s. And so that's no good, but they can make the right decision for the 2030s.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Tuesday. We are nearing the end of the realignment season as we get into the end of the year and go into our break, which is going to start next week as we go home to celebrate the holidays. We're really excited we've made it this far. And we wanted to say that we've got another great episode. Of course, this is with Steve Levine. He is the editor of the Information's Electric Newsletter. We're covering a topic that we've not really covered up until now, which is batteries, the automobile industry, and how this plays into the competition with the US and China, everything everyone's really interested in. We definitely know that we had to cover energy a lot more. So next year, we're looking for covering nuclear power and other things. They're delving into this. But Sagar, what's particularly good about this conversation with Steve?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Marshall. They just named Elon Musk Time Magazine's Person of the Year. So this is really the time, and you guys are going to realize how deeply embedded Elon Musk is in the entire conversation around electric cars. But to me, it's just all about supply chain, supply chain, supply chain, supply chain. This has been the year of the supply chain. We are all going to have an intimate knowledge of it. The most poignant thing that Steve says is, oh, if you care about the America winning the 2020s in the electric vehicle war, it's literally over. It's just like semiconductors. We lost. We did not prepare properly. If you want a chance at winning, we have to start investing now in the year 2021. And then there is a possibility that we can possibly compete in the year 2030. That's how dire the situation is. It's something Steve's been talking about for a long time. And I think you guys are going to love this conversation for that reason. He's such a prescient figure in this field.
Yeah, and we definitely recommend you subscribe to the Electric newsletter if you're interested. Right. Link in the show notes. Okay, quick things. Number one, because we got a review saying we need to speed these up. I agree. Number one, Book Shop. It's nearing the holiday season. Go follow the link. We're going to put out a special list this Thursday's upcoming episode with our recommendations of the year. So go check that out. Two, you can subscribe to our Substack. Goes out on Thursdays. Man, the open rate has been going up. Thank you so much. And we're at 40%. Actually, genuinely, good newsletter. Yeah, that's actually like a really good list. So keep enjoying that. Go check that out. Original content there as well. Finally, huge thank you, Lincoln Network. Thank you for supporting the show. Let's get into it. Steve Levine, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, nice to see you guys.
Good to see you, Steve.
We're doing something that I like to do a lot, which is discuss a topic that's incredibly important, electric vehicles, competition between the US and China, the state of the automotive industry, with someone who put out a very specific piece of work a few years ago. So we're talking about your most recent book, Powerhouse: Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. Quick interesting note that we'll get into right now, in between the publication in 2015 and the book's release in paperback in 2016, the title was changed to The Powerhouse: America, China, and the Great Battery War, almost as if something was happening in the broader narrative that would cause the publisher to reformat that. I'd just love for you to introduce the idea and what you were focusing on in the book, and then we'll just work our way through and get to the present day.
Sure. So first, thanks for having me. This is great. At that time, it was very, very early days of batteries, electric cars. Even though Elon Musk was on the radar screen, the Tesla S already existed. This whole world that we're seeing right now is very much aspirational. Elon was basically the only one on the turf, and batteries were very far from being able to enable a commercial mainstream electric car. The geopolitics were also aspirational. I though saw that I came from a world of oil. As you know, my first book was on oil and the geopolitics of oil. It was on the struggle between the United States and Russia for control of the Caspian Sea. And what I did when I saw the world of batteries and electric cars was simply substitute batteries for oil, batteries and geopolitics. And so that's what that, so that book was about what would happen if the United States or China or Japan or whomever was the one who mastered the battery, who created the conceit of that book is the super battery, the search, the quest for the super battery. And if one country or one company in one country captured that, what would happen? And then I put myself in a lab, a single lab, Argonne National Lab. They invented the formulation that's in most of the electric cars around the world. It's not in the Chinese cars. They've got LFP there, but the NMC and the NCA, that was invented at Argonne. I put myself for 2 years in their lab and just watched when when those scientists, these are young guys, they're all in their 20s, maximum 30. And when they actually, when they went into the lab every day, they thought if they invented that super battery, they were going to save the world. They're all climate change, I want to say fanatics, you know, they're in that world. And so that's what they were after. So that's what the book, the narrative of the book follows that team as they try to create the super battery. You're there with all of the human emotions involved in very high stakes, but difficult, very difficult invention. And then the substrate is what happens if they succeed.
So this is really interesting, and it's fascinating too, because I remember that time. I was actually in a graduate school class around energy, and I remember the professor talking about how the future was going to be batteries. And I remember being like, yeah, this sounds like BS. My dad is also a professor in power electronics, so I've been hearing this type of propaganda since the 1990s. But then it actually did start to become about batteries. Cars, Tesla. And the first time I ever saw one, I thought, wow, that really is like a leap forward within these wars. In the context of where we're at today in 2021, what are the actual resource, quote unquote, wars that are happening? So I see a lot about the raw inputs of batteries themselves. Tesla right now asking the US government for a tariff waiver on graphite. What are the so-called like resource wars around the batteries that will enable the push for electric cars?
Yeah. This is a very good question because we're at the very outset, onset of that. So you're getting ahead. We are actually heading into a period in which certain parts of the world become flashpoints, just what you're flagging. And what's different, closing that loop from what Marshall asked, the difference between then, 2015, and now is then it was aspirational. What the heck are batteries? Just what you stated. Who cares? Yeah. And now, well, we care, right? And we know what they are. But we know what they are, and we're setting up gigantic gigafactories everywhere. But what's going to go into those cells? That's the resources: the cobalt, nickel, manganese, copper, graphite, lithium. It's not the metals. The metals, they're where they are. We can't change that. But the refined version of those, that's what goes into, and China controls that whole chain, that supply chain, 70 to 80% over the last decade, while we were sitting, all of us except Elon Musk, were sitting here doing nothing and thinking batteries were stupid. China was creating that chain, that chain. And so when you ask, we are competing, the United States is competing with China, there are our greatest technological rival. We have put ourselves in a position where we are asking China to supply us to compete with it. Now is so that is the setup for these, the resource war. That's the flashpoint. Is China going to, did anyone ask China? Are they going to supply us? And not just now, reliably, as this ramps up over the next decade and beyond, are they willing to reliably through the decade to everyone supply? And I think there's a big question mark around that. And if you're familiar with the rare earths conflict that happened in 2010, China and Japan got into a boat ramming incident in the East China Sea, and China stopped the rare earth shipments around the world, not just with Japan, and that went on for several months. So there's a precedent for this. We are putting ourselves into an untenable position. I don't see there's a lot of talk. There's very little action. The only action that I have seen, you mentioned Tesla asking for the tariff, lifting of the tariff on graphite. But it's still the raw material. Who's going to process that? Right now, China processes 100% of the graphite for anodes, 100%. And so Volkswagen this week announced we are doing a deal with Umicore. It's a big Belgian battery metals supply company, the process metals. So they're starting. But what about, even Tesla has not announced we're going to establish our own chain. GM, of course, and Ford have not either.
There's so many different places we're going to have to take this, because you said a lot of really interesting things there. In no particular order, let's start with this. Sagar and I both came of age during the 2000s. So when you say that Elon Musk was the only person, not person, but, you know, Elon Musk as embodying Tesla, our family owned a Nissan Leaf. Sagar's family owned a Chevy Volt. So where are those players? Nissan obviously being Japanese, Chevy being in this Obama post 2008 financial crisis bit there. Why are you seemingly dismissing those efforts in the story you're telling?
Right. So it's true that, one, I'm telling an American story, and it is true that there was the Nissan Leaf, and two, I'm talking about pure EVs. The Volt was a hybrid, was a plug-in hybrid, 37 miles. It went on a charge. And I think you know that it was a superb vehicle. Like, a lot of people say, wow, this is great. But GM has stopped making them. It had a limited vision, and Musk had the vision. He created the S, you know, its sales in 2012 off the charts. The Leaf, you know, it has sold well over time, but again, Nissan stopped with that, hasn't shown a vision since then, and so I do think that yes. And don't forget the BMW i3, right? BMW in 2017 or so came in with that with the i3. So you had a German vehicle too. But okay, they're there. But really, it's Musk and China. They are the actors. They basically had the field, apart from these little players who are on the field too, but Musk and China had, you know, pick your percentage. You know, they were the big players. They kept going. They built up their capacity. That's why they're running away with as of now, China and Tesla are running away with the game.
Another thing that comes up hearing this story you're telling is at the start of the episode, you're describing the idea is if you develop this technology, you could use this technology to dominate the market. And it seems as if the US and China both developed their own versions of this technology, but it seems as if the race is actually coming down to manufacturing and supply chains. So it's not, so that I think that's an interesting comment on how the, let's say the EV revolution is different than the industrial revolution previously. But can you just expand on like what that, how the thesis around, if you get this technology first, you're going to win, how that basically plays out? Because it seems to me that you could develop the technology, but if you lack the supply chains or the manufacturing capacity, it doesn't really matter. And that seems to be not something people are thinking about in 2014, 2015.
Right. They weren't thinking about it then. And Marshall, they're barely thinking about it now. I can tell you this conversation that we're having right now is right on the cutting edge. And it's incredible because it's so important. But it's two things. One, yes, you cannot win without the supply chain. That's for sure. And it and when people think of the supply chain, also they think they're thinking the raw lithium. Well, hey, Elon announced on Battery Day that he is he's going to develop a lithium mine in Nevada. Okay, he announced that. Nothing has happened since then. And again, still, that's the raw metals. It's the processed, again, it's the processing part that really counts. Or they're thinking about the gigafactory. Hey, Musk is putting up 4 gigafactories, Shanghai, Austin, Berlin, Fremont. No, he doesn't, because again, he doesn't have the midstream. But there's that the other piece is that and I think the car makers understand this now, although it took them a long time, and that's that people have to want these vehicles. You can't force someone to buy, mainstream folks to buy an electric car just because it exists. And the car has to be cool, has to be really desirable. BMW, for example, who, you know, apart from Tesla, wants to win this more than anyone. Have you looked at its 2 electric cars, the ID3, ID4?
To be honest.
They're the ugliest, like no one would ever want to buy these vehicles. And
so this actually goes to somewhere. I was going to talk about this later, but I want to talk about it now. Because there is a renaissance happening. I mean, the Ford Mustang Mach-E is cool. That is a cool looking car. Definitely, like I said, like Marshall said, my dad had a Chevy Volt in the early days and it was terrible. This is an awful car. Really? Sorry, Chevy. It was garbage. Like I said, he's an electric car geek. Marshall's, I remember riding in that Nissan Leaf. It was okay. Now my dad has a Tesla. The Tesla's awesome. Like, let's be real. But the new generation of the Ford cars on electric seems to me a generational leap forward. So can you tell me the story of Detroit catching up in the electric car race? And Ford, as usual, has always been one of the more forward-looking brands there in Detroit. Or do you think I'm mischaracterizing it? And is Tesla still so far ahead of the field?
Yeah, so I'll say the end first. Yes, Tesla is far away from in the field, but I'll tell the whole thing, and that's that. GM has had numerous opportunities to be way ahead of the game. They had the EV1 in the 90s, and then famously canceled it. They had the Volt, have discontinued that. They had the Bolt. The Bolt came out 4 months, 7 months before the Model 3.
Yeah.
But look at the Bolt and then compare it with the Model 3. Why, GM, you invented the Camaro, you invented the Stingray. Why did you come out with the Bolt instead of something that looks like Model 3? So that's them. But let me finish with GM. So GM had those opportunities. Ford has been asleep at the wheel the whole time. About 2 years ago, 1.5 or 2 years ago, it suddenly dawned on them and VW too. Shit, this is really happening.
Yeah,
we are going to be Kodak. We're going to be Nokia, and so both of them suddenly started announcing tens of billions of dollars of investments in becoming electric vehicle companies. And that's all these announcements. And a very key moment, September 22nd, 2020, Battery Day, Musk revolutionized the technology presentation by making it cool to have a battery day. Now, everyone has had a battery day. Before that battery day, no one would have done that. And anyway, but he just, they are in terror. They are visibly, Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford, Herbert Diess, the CEO of Volkswagen, they visibly voice how afraid they are of losing this game to Tesla. So they are their followers. Yes, they're very aggressive, but all of the vehicle companies, except for a couple of Chinese companies, which we can come to, but the Western vehicle companies are behind. They're following Tesla, and yes, the Mach 3, and the F-150 Lightning, and the Hummer, the GM Hummer. These are like out of this world cool. Like they are selling big orders, and they will sell a lot of vehicles. I'm wondering though, they're cherry picking. They're cherry picking their iconic vehicles. These are companies that are accustomed to selling 10 million vehicles a year. And so, okay, what are the other vehicles they're going to come up with?
Right. You know, and here's the other main question. What happened to the Japanese? I mean, my parents, before my dad got obsessed with electric cars, it was only Toyota. Like, that's like every Indian family has a Toyota Camry. You know, it's, sorry, go ahead,
Mark. Let me interject after you and you're done, Sagar.
Yeah, I mean, just like, they famously dominated the American car market from what, 1980 almost, up until the late 2000s. And yet in the electric car race, they appear absolutely nowhere to be found, at least in our market. I don't know what they're doing in Japan. Why have they fallen so far behind? Or have they just decided we're going to be the dominant makers of oil-powered cars?
One quick thing to add to this, I'm reviewing my Portland, Oregon roots, but my family not only owned a Nissan Leaf, but we owned a Honda Insight. We had a Toyota Prius. Like, we've really got the hat trick of, like, you know, but those are hybrids. So it's not just that they dominated in the 80s and 90s against the American auto manufacturers. It seems like
they literally had
the hybrids too.
Yeah.
And the Prius actually sold. People actually really bought the Prius. What happened with this story?
Yeah, so we forgot that, the Prius, right? In this conversation, that they're the revolutionaries, right? What happened to that? To them? This is a good question. One thing we have to keep in mind is everything that we are saying is hypothetical. We are assuming that that in the 2020s and that EVs become a mainstream thing and everyone's buying them, and we don't know that yet. What we know, we have a supply signal. We don't know about the demand signal. And so the Japanese, Toyota, the largest vehicle maker in the world for consumer vehicles, isn't sure, right? They're ambivalent. And they think that, at least for the 2020s, that hybrids are going to be the biggest selling electrified vehicles and not EVs. And that even when there are EVs, it's not going to be batteries, but that fuel cells. They're going for hydrogen fuel cells. And there's some, right? Toyota has introduced a couple of battery electric vehicles, and you know, because it's Toyota, they'll be very cool and they'll be reliable and all that. But that's the story of Japan. Japan has is ambivalent about the EV. You know, I'm putting my fingers up in quote marks, since this is just audio, revolution. And so that's what you're seeing. Sagar, that's what you're seeing.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I guess the next question here is everything here really coming back to Elon Musk? Because, and it's frustrating talking about him because you don't want to just sound like a fanboy, but it seems like a way of understanding this story here is that because the market hasn't actually shown up yet, This is all hypothetical. It was hypothetical in 2010. It's hypothetical now. But it seems like Elon Musk and his ability to meme the Tesla stock into the stratosphere has just forced companies to jump in and compete, even though, like you said at the Japanese example, the market quite isn't there yet. It seems like to really understand the difference between 2010 and now is really just that factor. Is that the way I should understand this story?
Well, he's real, right? I mean, he is selling vehicles at a million right now. He won't sell a million cars this year. He'll sell 900,000, but he's selling at a million vehicle a year clip. That, like, this quarter, if he had four quarters like this, it would be 1.2 million. That's a serious company. Those are serious sales. He's only selling four vehicles, and really only two, because the S and the X, they're
those are luxury,
trivial. Yeah. And that's incredible. So he's real. BYD, the Chinese company, you know, when I was talking about China, that's a real company. It's going to, BYD has, in my view, the most revolutionary commercial battery on the market today. Hmm. And it's not very well, the company isn't very well known outside of China yet. It's somewhat known in connection with Warren Buffett, but it's a kick-ass company. Its cars are impressive. And as I say, the battery, it's called the Blade. And they make it themselves. And, they will sell millions of cars a year, just like Tesla will. But I do think, Marshall, you're getting at a couple of things, I think. Are you getting at, is Tesla shares?
I'm not questioning Tesla shares. I'm just building on what you said around the Japanese skepticism, because like you said, this whole idea of there being a massive market for EVs is still actually unproven. So when you're saying Ford's jumping in, GM is jumping in, Volkswagen has other ads, my reaction is, holy shit, Elon Musk seems to have just personally, in a great man of history style thing, for good or for ill, created so much fear of missing out.
Yes.
At a level that governments, this narrative, this seems to be what 2005 of hybrids and 2010 with the post-financial crisis Chevy Volt moment really lacked. Is that a correct interpretation?
Yes. Yes. It is. I mean, it's not quite a head fake, because it's not a fake, but he has put the fear of death into all of these companies. Everyone is betting, except the Japanese, are betting everything on electric vehicles. And it's all I would just be repeating what you already said very well. So the answer is yes.
Let's test the hypothesis though, Steve. If I'm Toyota, America's not my only market. If you've ever been to India, there's a shitload of Toyotas there. Ever go and look at a video of ISIS, you know, Toyota Hilux. The middle of Africa, Toyota Highlander. Electric vehicle stations ain't coming to the middle of Africa, to rural India, to a huge part of the developed world for 50 years, if it actually is the thing. So is electric vehicles just a luxury, semi-luxury market? I mean, even here in the United States, getting an electric vehicle cost down. What does a Toyota Camry cost, right? Or a Corolla right now? Probably like $19,000-ish, right? Okay, something like that. When is an electric car going to cost $19,000 and have the ease in order to drive it across the entire country and not have to stop, you know, for 30 minutes at best at one of the superchargers and all of that? Like, when I'm testing this assumption from the Toyota view, it actually makes a lot of sense. I would probably bet on the hybrid model too.
Yeah, yeah. I think two things are going on. One is that Toyota might be right. We don't know, and we have to keep our wits about us. I mean, most of this of the folks who talk about this subject are biased. They're either total fanatics or they're skeptics. And so, you know, you try to stay in the middle. But I think two scenarios may be right. One is the one you just stated. Toyota may be right. But there's another one. There's a concept out there in computer land called the Osborne effect, and that's when a new product is anticipated, and the market anticipates it, and stops buying the current product, and all those folks who make that go out of business. Mm. And even though
what's an example of when that's happened?
Oh, so Osborne. There's Osborne. So he in the 1980s, well, see, we don't, he's not a name anymore, but in around 1980, he was one of the main desktop computer makers. And so in the UK. And so he, you know, his first Osborne one was this great hit. And then he announced, and just wait till you see the Osborne two. It's going to knock your socks off. I'm coming out with it next September. Sales stopped on the Osborne one, and he went bankrupt. Right? He didn't have the wherewithal to put out the Osborne two. This is just Google this. It's a Wikipedia.
Yeah.
It's famous. But in Germany just approved. I think it's a Mercedes Level 3 hands-free vehicle. They legalized, it's just happened, this vehicle that you can drive and take your hands off the wheel and your eyes off the road. And, you know, electric vehicles, I've been looking for an Osborne signal, right? The point at which people, the mass of people decide the car that I'm in is either obsolete or it's going to be obsolete. I better dump it and buy an electric vehicle. But I have trouble thinking that that's going to happen with electric, but I could see that happening if it's electric in conjunction with something like Level 3 autonomous driving. But if the public believes, especially moms are the main decider. This is a statistical fact.
Consumer research.
Main decider vehicle purchases in the United States. If moms decide that I'm not putting my kids into a car that doesn't have autonomous capability with all the safety sensors and all that in there, then suddenly all the vehicles that don't have this autonomous capability are subject to the Osborne effect. And this thing that happened with Mercedes, that's a potential Osborne signal, and it's the opposite. You got Toyota on one end, this Mercedes signal on the other.
This episode is helpful because Sagar and I are both children of the suburbs, and we've obviously lived in cities, so we've been really checked out from the auto discussion since high school. And something I've recently learned is that American manufacturers don't make minivans anymore. That's just not like, you know, I grew up in a Ford Windstar that became the Freestar, but that's just not a class of vehicle. So as we're talking about electric batteries, and you're saying things like moms decide vehicles, that's obviously where we think of concepts such as the soccer mom driving a minivan. What are the makes of autos that we're going to see in a world where the electric vehicle thesis is largely correct? So you reference there being an electrified Hummer. You know, you think of gas guzzling SUVs during the 2000s as being like very specifically tied to oil. How should we think about the way cars will look in the scenarios that the optimists are looking at?
I'm generally battery led, and so in terms of EVs, I'm looking at what the plans are, right? The plans for it's a future that looks like today. A lot of pickup trucks, a lot of SUVs. So a lot of the vehicles and the leading vehicles that are planned are crossover SUVs, and everyone is coming out with a pickup truck. And you know, these are the two kinds of vehicles around the world that are the most purchased vehicles.
Interesting. I don't get the pickup truck one. I mean, yeah,
say it. Thank you. You know, I was going to ask.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm from Texas. I knew a lot of people with pickup trucks, but a lot of them like actually needed them. You know, but if I could be in a city, well, like I, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah. I don't either. I don't know it. I don't get it either, but there, so Ford, which sells, you know, it's F-150 is the best selling vehicle of any kind for 43 years straight. And some people who are buying it need them. Most people don't. My brother, we grew up in the same house in California, so it's not pickup truck land. He has two F-150s. And I said, well, what are you, I mean, do you have a pencil that you need to put in the back or what are you? And it's, and he won't admit that it's a cultural thing. He wants
to, just likes it. Right.
Yeah. He wants to look like he's an F-150 guy. But Ford is saying that 75% of the orders that they've gotten for the Lightning are new customers to the company. So who are they?
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I was excited by the Lightning when I saw it. I was like, that's awesome. Same with the Mustang Mach-E. I was like, oh, I would absolutely, like, if I need a new car, like, I absolutely would buy that car. I think it's interesting when we're talking about this in the way of, like, leading consumer preference and all of that. Let's actually get to the share price discussion, because this is probably one of the most overhyped plus controversial discussions. Obviously, we have Rivian, which is worth, like, more than, you know, as yet
more
to
than Ford,
I think yet to produce an actual car or ship a car, right? And is worth more than Ford Motor Company. Tesla, of course, famously, you know, worth than I think at one point than all three of Detroit Auto combined. What do you see within that? Because on the one hand, if they're right, then Tesla share price right now is a bargain. If they're going to be the dominant electric vehicle manufacturer of a newly electric world, whatever it costs right now is nothing. That's like buying Amazon in 1994. On the other hand, I mean, does it really make sense for it to be priced in at this exact time relative to the sales, the revenue, and all of that compared to the people who produce the vast majority of cars in America? So put your financial analyst hat on and give us your take.
Yeah, yeah, I do think about this. Tesla actually, its capitalization is it's more than that of the top nine automakers around the world combined.
Yeah,
and Rivian's is Ford and Chevy put together. It's more than those put together. So they're, you know, valued highly. I think both of them are way overvalued. So Rivian is, I've driven a Rivian truck, and they have in fact produced, so they've produced, I think the numbers, the last one I saw is like 156. So it's right. A small number, right? And those were distributed, I think, among employees. I guess it's a cool truck. I mean, I haven't been in that many big pickup trucks, but honestly, I was underwhelmed, you know, like for example, you know, you hear about the Tesla S Plaid, and it's got, you know, the computer screen in the front. It's got the computer screen in the back. Why do you want a computer screen in the back? Because you've got your kids in the back. You're taking a long drive. They can play computer games, you know, and leave you in peace. Right. And also it has, Tesla has got access to, right, Disney Plus and Hulu and Netflix, right? So you can watch movies too. I mean, I have a friend. He's a battery professor at CMU, Carnegie Mellon, and he's got an S. He told me that he and his wife are so hooked on this one game that's only available in the S that they actually sit in the car in their driveway to play this game. But the Rivian, they've got just the screen in the front. There's no screen in the back. And there's no apps. There are no games, there are no movies or nothing. And I'm thinking, okay, the base price for this is $80,000. And I asked,
that's a lot of money.
Do people really want to pay? I asked them. They say, yeah, this is the going Right. I was with Rivian people. They took me out. Yeah, this is what people pay for these. And it is true. I'll tell you this. Everywhere we went in that vehicle, people stopped and they wanted to take a picture of it. And they came to the window and they're asking about it. So it does it for people who are into trucks. They're like, it does have eye appeal. But I wonder, you know, Ford is selling 4 to 5 million vehicles a year. GM sells 9 or 10. How many $80,000 pickup trucks and SUVs? They're making an SUV. Are they going to sell? They're not going to sell. There aren't. They're not going to sell that many. Rivian is a niche player. It's always going to be a niche player. They're going to be known. They're going to sell a lot of delivery vans to Amazon. Mm-hmm. And that's who it is. And Lucid. Lucid, you know, makes the Model S on steroids. Right? People who, I haven't driven a Lucid, but folks who have, they just say it's out of this world. Amazing. It costs $169,000. So how many, again,
can you answer this? What is the point of these two companies? Because my thing is, if I have $80,000 to spend on an electric vehicle, I'm going to Tesla. So that's already a niche in of itself. And you're saying these are niches of niches. Like what is the purpose of these companies?
Yeah. Is that a rhetorical question?
No. I'm asking you seriously. For example, the reason, a good way of summing up like the past 100 years of automotive history is that there are all these different auto manufacturers. There didn't need to be this many auto manufacturers. So we've gradually seen makes, models, brands coalesce. Who buys a Buick anymore? So I don't understand why we would need to go the opposite direction when it came to electric vehicles. You yourself just said it. If you want to buy a pickup truck, you're probably buying a Ford. It seems to me, why would that be any different when it comes to electric vehicles, as long as Tesla is producing enough different models and enough different categories?
Yeah. So you're right. So they'll sell some. A lot of these companies aren't going to exist at the end of the 2020s. There's going to be massive consolidation. I've tried to think about who, but I mean, of the automakers, just like oil, right? The oil companies, Exxon bought Mobil, Chevron bought Texaco, right? I mean, the companies that you see, they consolidate. Are Ford and GM, are they both going to exist? Is VW, Mercedes, and BMW, are they all going to exist? Toyota, Nissan,
Honda. Let's not leave out Honda.
There's going to be massive consolidation. Some of them are not going to make it. This 2020s, the outcome of the 2020s is being decided now. We don't know what the answer is, but the folks making the right decisions at this moment, they're going to be the winners at the end of this decade.
So quick follow-up on that. So when you say the folks making those decisions, who are those folks? Are those folks people at auto companies? Are they officials at like the Department of Energy? Are they people in labs? Like who are the people making the decision? And obviously the massive consumers, who are the players who are making those choices now?
Okay, so let's take China and Tesla out of the equation, because we've already said they're players on the field because they set up their whole chain. They're set. Okay, so the decision makers are what are the other automakers doing to make sure they don't lose, and so the decisions they're making and the decisions that battery makers made as to what formulation they're making their own supply chain, the pace at which they are made, when are they coming onto the market? Are they capitalized? Do you go SPAC? Was that really a smart decision? Or do you try to sell yourself, you know, in the battery space? Lithium metal anodes are a huge thing. The three leading lithium metal anode companies have all made different bets how they think is the best way to succeed. Who's going to be right? I have my doubts at all three. So these sorts of decisions made on those levels are important. Who makes the right decision on supply chain? Right back where we began. Like, I've been banging the supply chain drum for weeks, maybe even months. You know, I've kind of lost track, and is writing every single week. Where's your supply? You know, are you doing this? Are then and I've thought, I cannot be like, I'm just some dude in Maryland, right? And so those guys, it's their business to know this. So, and I'm asking around, right? Is no one really doing anything, or are they doing it behind the scenes so I'm not seeing it? And at some point they're going to come out and say, ta-da. And what I'm getting is, no, there's no secret. They're not yet doing it. But those who make like those decisions are going to be key. And if they don't make the right decisions on getting their supply side, their supply chain set up, those who don't they will be on the ash heap at the end of the decade.
Yeah. I mean, everything you're saying just validates, I don't know, Steve, I can't help but be pretty despondent here. I just did a monologue on this, the Wall Street Journal piece, that just came out a couple of days ago. It was fantastic around Tesla. I'm sure, you know, you've probably been long familiar writing about this, but I mean, Tesla has essentially grown and helped build the entire domestic Chinese supply chain to which they can funnel to BYD and many of these other amazing companies. In terms of the New York Times did a big expose on Chinese control of cobalt mines in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I mean, it does truly, I know it's incredibly cliche, the Tom Friedman, like the Chinese play chess, the West play checkers, but this actually does seem to be one of those areas where that appears to be true. I mean, do we have any hope of domestically sourcing and spinning up our own battery supply chain? Because we've already lost or on semiconductors. We're basically playing catch up on that. That's a 7 year ago game. Are we even capable of doing it on batteries?
I'm going to throw a question back at you, guys. Let me though say first is the 2020s are lost. It takes so long, even if they everyone makes the right decision now, it takes a while to get everything going. So U.S. companies, including Tesla, will be reliant on the Chinese supply chain for the whole 2020s. And you're looking at the chip, what's happening with chips, that's batteries for the 2020s. And so that's no good. They can make the right decision for the 2030s. I mean, OPEC came on our radar screen. Okay, it was it was created in 1960, but it only became a real thing in the 1970s. But we're still, 50 years later, we're still with it. And so that means that, okay, you lose one decade, but it's okay, you can come back 2030s and 2040s. But this is the thing I was going to ask you guys is that what really, speaking of being dismayed, I've been dismayed at how, apart from Musk, how non-visionary, non-gutsy the other players are. So Musk and China anticipated the market. They built their chain before there was any hope that there would be demand for what they were going to produce. They had a vision. Where's the vision? Where is the guts? I'm going to put down on this bet. And I'm thinking back to, the Gilded Age and, the steel barons and oil barons and the railroad barons and those guys. Okay. They had character problems, but they had guts. Right? They're willing to put down bets. What's happened to us Americans? That's my question.
Well, I mean, the thing here, and this is, and I'm glad you brought up the robber barons and character problems, because it gets to how this is a frustrating answer for folks, which is the answer is, so Elon Musk came from Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, for good or for ill, was the last truly dynamic and visionary. Not all of it, right? We're not talking about random ad sales companies, but, Silicon Valley, for a variety of obviously profit generating reasons, is probably one of the last dynamic parts of the economy. And, the auto, if you're a person who's drawn to vision, why are you joining Ford Motor Company in 1998? Like, why, who is possibly doing that if you're, it's a broader problem in American society, but sorry, I'd love to hear your thing there too.
I mean, the one, yeah, like you said, the Elon answer is actually easy, which is that working PayPal in the 1990s and working in venture actually does equip you to make bets, which are going to be 100x. That's the entire business. He just did it with raw materials in two particular cases, both Tesla and SpaceX. The real answer is why enough people in Silicon Valley, not enough people, are not doing that in the hardware business. That's actually my question, which is that why are there not enough people who have this obvious mindset, which works in software, turn towards hardware? The answer, as Elon has showed, is it's a pain in the ass. It takes 20 years and you still may not prove it. It actually is a huge bet. On the Chinese side, the answer is also simple. It's easy when you're an authoritarian country and you just don't have to have any, you know, democratic response.
Solyndra happens and no one cares.
Right. It's like made in China. Yeah, exactly. How many Solyndras have happened in Chinese history? Probably a ton. I'm never going to hear about it. It's easy when you have a made in China 2025 plan, which is predicated on like, okay, we have, you know, one belt, one road. We have X amount of oil, which we're going to guarantee for the Persian Gulf. It'd be better for the Chinese people and the long-term prosperity of the CCP if we have domestic EVs, which means, boom, we're going to, you know, ensnare Elon Musk into our country with the Shanghai Giga Shanghai plant and basically control him politically for the rest of his life. And also grow our domestic supply chain. The win-win situation. He becomes the world's richest man. We grow supply chain and bet big. Like, it's not a bet whenever you can control all of the inputs. I think the bet was much bigger on Elon's side. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's sad. It's a sad state of affairs. My main criticism would be, and this is a very cold take, it's Peter Thiel's, which is that we do not have enough visionary thinking in the world of atoms and bits. Like, you know, the coolest thing I've seen this year is about mini nuclear reactors. That's pretty much it. I can't think of a single other thing or invention or device, anything that will actually change the world 10 years from now. So that's a long-winded way, but I have thought about it a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a whole other discussion, but it's the Chinese approach, that top-down approach. It's not as simple as you put it. If it were, Russia would be China too.
Sure.
Right? And so it takes, you've got a bunch of guys in a room, and you know, they make a lot of mistakes, but they also have made some very smart decisions.
Yeah, I shouldn't downplay it. Listen, I respect them. Like, people always come after me like, oh, China, Sinophobe, whatever. Listen, I respect who they are. Like, I'm afraid of them because I respect their ability in order to execute. As you said, this is not a bunch of idiotic, corrupt oligarchs who just want to buy homes in London. These are serious folks who've thought actually a lot. And, you know, look, technocracy is not easy. If it was, every authoritarian country on earth,
North Korea would have been crushing it right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, effective technocracy is actually really hard. So, look, you know, I respect the game.
I think one thing we can do, look at how many of our big tech companies are now led by Indian immigrants, right? And I think that look at the problem we've got with labor shortage in so many fields. I think that one of the things we could do to resolve the problem we're discussing, this lack of vision, lack of guts, is immigrants. I mean, have a really smart rethink. We've become xenophobic, we've become jingoistic, and we've got a very black and white idea of what immigration is, and we need an influx, a smart immigrant policy. We need we need to open the doors to more immigrants.
So quick last two questions here. One, and Sagar may need to drop. So Sagar, if you have to drop, that's okay.
Yeah, apologies.
Before we cut for these two questions. So question number one would be, we keep talking about losing, but a lesson we could take from the 1980s is that when the Japanese were flooding the American market with cars, the Reagan administration very aggressively stepped in. So as I'm hearing this discussion, I don't see a world where a U.S. government, Republican, Democrat, Andrew Yang does something, whatever, would allow Chinese EVs, Chinese batteries to flood the American market. I don't see that happening. So is there going to be a world where essentially we're going to have very localized auto industries? As in you're going to have like the Chinese block, you're going to have like the American block plus Japan and Europe. Is that a useful way to think of how this will go down in the 2020s?
Well, the world is regionalizing. That's going on before our eyes. So there's no question about that. And it's breaking up into you know, the U.S. and China are trying to extract each other themselves from the other's sphere. That is going on. That's when Beijing ordered Didi, the mobile company to delist from the New York Stock Exchange. That just happened, right? So that's what that is. But Chinese cars already have a beachhead in Europe. Chinese electric cars. And there are a few on the West Coast in the United States too. BYD and NIO both have some vehicles that they're kind of test driving in California. It's problematic. There's a political problem there, but at minimum, we will continue to have, it's not Chinese completed batteries, but it's all the guts that go into the batteries are and will be for the whole decade Chinese.
And so that leads us to our last question here. You said it yourself, we should assume that this decade is lost. Like, what should informed listeners, et cetera, do this decade to make sure the 2030s and 2040s, like, what's the call to action intellectually, action wise? Like, how should we think about that?
Supply chain. So everything else is happening. Push themselves. Are your listeners themselves investors? Are they
all over the map?
Are they business
consumers, investors, business, politics, everything?
Start a battery metals processing company, right? Start to get into, like, this is a winning business. You're at the front end. Be a part of the nascent, and when I say nascent, that's being very charitable. Battery metals processing industry, and just do that, right? Cobalt, nickel, lithium. That's the biggest thing you could do.
There you go. Build shit again. It's a simple thing.
Build shit again. Yeah. That's BSA.
Yeah, there you go. Producerism, as my friend Matt Stoller likes to call it. Steve, we really appreciate you joining us, sir. This is a really, frankly, informative episode. You're going to have to come back and update us, because this is just fascinating. You're somebody who really cuts through it and really helped me think about it, and I'm sure Marshall as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
He enjoyed it. Let's do it again.
Absolutely.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.